Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Flores
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies, gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around. It's another episode of This Life. So get your iPad out and put your whatever those little earplugs you put in your ears.
AirPods?
What are they called?
AirPods?
AirPods.
AirPods.
Put the AirPods in. And another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob and Shelly.
And Shelly's sitting in with us again, which we really appreciate.
Hi,
Shelly.
Guys.
And
you may have to be here.
You may have to run out at some point.
Yes.
Yeah, so you're welcome to. So we are joined by a special guest, Lana Turner, comedian, actress, singer. She was married to Ralphie May, who was one of my favorite comics. And wait a minute. Where did you guys meet?
What do you mean, Ralphie and I?
Yeah.
We met in Houston.
Okay.
So like 20 years ago.
What am I reading about Last Comic Standing?
What do you mean?
She and Ralphie. Ralphie was on Last Comic.
Yeah, Ralph was on Last Comic. Yeah,
okay,
that's where his career took off.
Took off.
Yep.
And we watched your 1 hour stand up special called "So I Wrote a Song About It."
Yeah.
Some of your stuff is so goddamn funny.
I know.
Thank
it's so.
You.
I mean, it's. I mean, seriously. Like, yeah, I was like, that's like Ralphie level. That to me is like really important. That's like as funny as it gets.
Well, it's kind of tough because sometimes you'll meet the spouse of somebody who's successful, but I'm a legitimate comedian.
Well, I was thinking about that, how hard that must be for you. But your writing is so funny. Do you write for television or anything?
I don't. I've written some projects, but I always joke I was the woman behind the man. You just couldn't see me back there.
Yeah. I'm sure. But,
I had the blessing, though, of being able to be a comedian for many, many years and not have to be in front of the, big thing. I didn't have to be in the limelight. I could just do what I love to do and raise children.
Yeah.
And that's unusual for a female comedian.
Yes.
And so I've been very, very blessed in that way.
So you didn't have the full female comedian spectrum.
Well, a lot of women aren't able to have babies in our business because, it's really hard to
do
it all.
It's too consuming.
Yeah, but I was able to have children and now I have to work a lot more, and I have no other skill set outside of dick jokes, so I have to figure this out fast.
You should be writing.
Well, they should be very popular at this point.
No, they're. I mean, it's
very
like
popular with me.
Thank you,
Shelly Duggan. Did you watch her special? You just
I did. I did, yeah. And I watched your late husband as well. And I'm sorry, but I just think it's so funny, and in a time where there's not a huge amount of laughter.
Aww.
Yeah. What Ralphie could do, I'm sorry, I hope we don't mind me. I like talking to Ralphie as much
no.
as you.
Oh, no, I mean, Ralphie.
Because I miss him. I miss him. And
him
I don't know if you know, I was walking down the street in Las Vegas with a friend of mine. I was like, oh, jeez, he's at Bally's. We got to go see him. I literally ran across the street and met up with him that night. And he was gone very soon after that. It was just heartbreaking.
Well, we did a podcast the night of the memorial, right?
Yeah, we did.
We did. It was weird. And Drew had to leave early. I'm so sorry about all this. But
the memorial is a blur for me. So, people continually come up and we saw you at the memorial. I'm like, I don't remember.
Yeah, I was at a distance, believe me.
Yeah.
Drew got there late, so don't worry.
It wouldn't have mattered to me. I honestly, some of my best friends talked to me that night, and I don't remember even talking to them.
And as horrible as it was, it wasn't. It's not like anyone went, oh, my God, that's impossible.
Right. What a surprise.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
wasn't a surprise.
Talk to us about that.
About it, part?
I never really knew. Well, I don't want to divulge any confidences or anything, but I really didn't. He never let me into that piece. And I had a very sort of friendly relationship with him.
Right.
But I don't know really what he was struggling with. I really don't know.
Oh.
I just could see it. I just didn't know what it was.
Yeah, I mean, he was really, really good at hiding his addictions. I mean, the most obvious one is the food addiction, which I didn't understand that for many, many years. When I first met him 20 years ago, we were friends first, and he sat me down and he was like, "You're thin. Will you help me lose weight?" And I was so naive to addiction that I was like, 2.5 pounds a week, right? And I said to him at that time, I go, "Please don't ask me to do something that you're not sincere in wanting to do, because once you ask me, I will never stop trying to help you. If I commit to this, you have to be equally as committed." And he was like, "No, I really want to." And I was like, "Put away the ranch. Let's start right now." Mm-hmm. And 17 years later, I was like, "Oh my God." But I rarely saw him eat anything that was that exceptional, but you would see evidence of it. Like one time, the worst one I ever saw was, I kept sugar and stuff out of the house. And so he would have to use, when I wasn't around, he'd have to go someplace and he would sneak out And I was like, are you having an affair or are you eating a cheeseburger? Like, I don't know what's going on. It makes you crazy. But I found the kids had a birthday party and I bought some M&Ms from Costco, the big bag. And one of those bags ended up in the pantry. You know, throw them in cookies, right? And he ingested that in a weekend. That's like 60 portions of M&Ms. And so when you see that, you're getting your calories. You just... It's in binging. It's scary.
So he was for 20 years aware of it and trying to do something about it. But did he think of like what most people do, the gastric bypass or the band or things like that? Did he think about doing that?
He had two surgeries on his stomach. One was a stapling. Like before I met him. And when I met him, he was 800 pounds. So the stapling was unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. After Last Comic Standing, and now we were together 7 years prior to Last Comic Standing. So I was with an 800-pound man. This is my, I have a lot of my own stuff to figure out. But 7 years into the relationship, he got gastric bypass and he lost 300 pounds.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it plateaued.
And he lost more than that though. Because I saw him,
at his smallest, he was probably maybe 550 or 450, 430 maybe.
430.
Wow. But then, you know, he would bounce between high fours, low fives after the gastric bypass. He just couldn't get out of that area. And towards the end of our marriage, I was very concerned. He was in and out of the hospital and rehab.
Mm-hmm. For what drug?
That's where I think you wanted to hear more. So rewind 7 years prior, he was always a pot smoker. There's no secret about that.
It heavy help with the food.
Heavy, yeah.
Okay.
And the hormonal imbalances and everything. But, you know, I mean, pot was a big part of his life and it helped him with some of the body pain that he had. But what happened was he had pulmonary embolisms.
Oh, my God.
And he was on a boat going, he was on a cruise ship working and he had pneumonia. And they took him off the boat on a gurney. It had progressed to the point where he was nearly dead on the boat. It was crazy. And they took him to the hospital in Tampa. I flew in and met him. And his feet and fingers were purple. Mm. And they got him on a heparin drip. And that's what saved his life. His sister actually did it for him. She was a nurse. She drove him from Orlando. And they moved him up into the ICU unit. And when he passed the clot, I was in the room with him. He completely stopped breathing. And his pupils were shaking and dilating. Mm. He was seconds from death. Oh, and a pulmonologist came in the room and they saved his life, and he was lucky that he shouldn't have lived. I think the doctor told us he had like a 30% chance of living through that weekend. And then he got out of there, but they said you cannot smoke pot anymore, but here's oxycodone, here's Percocet, here's Xanax, here's everything else.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And that's when
it got bad.
Yeah, this sweet person that I married, that I fell in love with, despite his size and other things that, you know, people see physically, like that would have probably not been like, because our relationship was so based on him and who he was, that shit stripped him of, mm-hmm. I mean,
of who he was.
And he was super depressed. And from that point on though, literally in the 7 years that followed, he was in and out of the hospital every 4 to 6 months. I think he had 11 hospitalizations and rehab stints in 7 years.
Oh, his last 7 years of life?
Oh no, the 7 years that we were together. Oh. And then what happened was we did rehab. Mm-hmm. I say we because I forced him into rehab, which didn't work.
Right.
Because, you know, $80,000 later.
Ugh.
And he didn't
want it. What, did he go to Malibu?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. You know, and I think what we were talking about right before we got on, you know, I think families are so desperate for that person to get
sober. And that's
sober.
Why these people take advantage of it.
Yeah. You will spend every bit.
You can. There's places like CryHelp. What's CryHelp cost for a month?
$10,000.
$10,000 for a month, and it's the highest level of care in terms of what they need.
I wanted to stay in rehab. I would go and visit him, and I'd be like, I want to stay here.
Shouldn't be like that.
It was beautiful.
It should not be like that.
The food was so good. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is crazy.
No good.
And did they address his eating problems, too?
I mean, the whole addiction cycle was supposed to be addressed.
Was he traumatized as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, he had his traumas.
Do we know what?
That's where things get really cloudy for me because...
he didn't even know, probably.
Well, he probably didn't tell her.
No.
Blocks it out.
He told me things that were absolutely horrific that would totally explain his issues. But a year after he left me, his mother stayed friends with me. She actually, you know, when people split up, it's messy and people try and figure out where they want to fit into the pieces. So his mother sat me down and she's like, I don't understand why he's doing this to you. And I go, well, maybe it was because of, you know, he's talked about this publicly, so I can share it here. Okay. Maybe it was because of his molestation. And his story about what he said,
he's confused.
And she had no knowledge of what he said. And his story was that she was privy to it and took him to the hospital and that he'd gone to court. Like, he had this whole big story that she absolutely denied. Mm-hmm. And his sister too. And then he had this massive car wreck, and he had a car wreck, but it was completely different than what his mother and sister had talked about.
Like, was he taking opiates by the time he told you this
stuff?
No. Nope. He told you way
before. He maintained these stories. I mean, I was devastated because for nearly two decades, this was the foundation of who he was and the reasons for I find it all so incredibly confusing. I would love for you to explain. I mean, I believe these stories for years, and why wouldn't I? If somebody tells you these things, you just want to hold them.
Well, and I'm sure something happened, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure something happened, but exactly what and what he made of it and why it was manufactured. I mean, memories are notoriously distorted.
Yeah.
Notoriously. But mom and sisters may have been distorted too. So,
and
somewhere in
so
there.
So different.
Especially
right.
Comedians do it a lot where it's hard to tell where the bit ends and the real life begins. Because I've known a lot of comedians that you don't know
that's
their stories are.
I was just going to say, waka waka, I was bleeding out my butt. Yeah, I mean, like, there was no gray area in the, like, there was no crossover to comedy in these stories. But yeah, I know, like, there's the creative mind.
Yeah, and exaggeration and the integration. I've seen a lot of comedians do this where they hear a story of a friend of theirs, kid. You know, something happened with that family, integrate it into their own and make it like it happened to them. And then they tell the story, the bit, so many times that all of a sudden they believe that it really actually happened to them.
I believe 1,000% that he believed the story.
Yes, that's
I just
what
think
I'm saying.
He got it off of Law and Order. I don't know where, because it was such a specific story.
Do you mind me asking what he said?
I mean, the car wreck has been so. I mean, I was devastated. The car wreck story, he told me his whole life. Basically, he's told it on other places. And I don't want to, like, shitbag on him at all. That's not my my goal. But basically, he'd had a car accident in which he'd gotten hit by a drunk driver, and the car ran off an embankment, and he broke 62 bones or, like, 72 separate breaks or something. He was in a coma.
Now, see, the reason I was sort
he's
of
a doctor, that can't have happened.
Well, no, that's the reason I want to assess.
Because
I can tell you what sort of what sounds right and what doesn't sound right. This sounds like that is some huge embellishment of something.
Well, here's
I don't know what.
Here's what
and
happens.
Maybe if I were betting man, I'd say maybe he was drinking and maybe something like that happened.
So the story
something happened though for
but
sure.
Something happened and there was a car accident.
It was a car accident. And after 17 years of the story, I'm sitting on the couch talking to his mother, and she goes, he ran off the road in a truck. There was another guy in the car with him. He flipped the vehicle into a empty lot. They were driving to go get alcohol to sell it at a Boy Scouts party or something like that.
Whoa.
And he totaled the truck. He broke his clavicle. Yeah. And that was basically it. And that, she got sued by the other kid's mother.
Yeah.
And her insurance policy ended up having to pay out. And when I heard this story, I was crying.
That sounds closer to reality.
Yeah,
that sounds closer to reality. Yeah. Well, I turned to his sister who was in the room, and I said, Melanie, what happened? Where were you? And she said, well, I was driving back to college. And I said, well, she's the RN that came down and helped with the heparin and helped save his life. I said, well, what happened? And she goes, Lana, if he'd had a stent in his brain, he'd have to been life flown into Little Rock because there ain't no neurosurgeons in Clarksville, Arkansas. And I was just like, oh, like 17 years of me.
Did you feel lied to?
I felt, yes, but I mean, I was.
Well, you know what it sounds like?
Wait. Do you feel manipulated into, that was part of his shtick to get you? Marry you?
No, I mean, I don't know. I would have loved him no matter what. Like, I think, Look, I don't want to like sit here and be like Ralphie, but like
Listen, I love Ralphie in any flavor.
Yes,
there's nothing you can say well, that's going to diminish my feelings about him and what he did for the world and his audiences. Mm-hmm. He's the one that suffers.
Right.
It's because of his own suffering that he did whatever he did with you. And he sounds like somebody. He reminds me of histrionic patients. Mm-hmm. Histrionic patients will sometimes come up with these tremendous.
See, well, what does that mean, histrionic?
It's a certain kind of personality structure.
But then we want to try to, you know, we want to pathologize like what this is
about.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And we want, because we want to understand it, right?
Right. I do too.
That happens.
Yeah, we don't want to.
But I deal with Ralphie's all the time, and at a certain point, it gets exhausting trying to figure out what the truth is.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have to just say, I don't know what the truth is, but I love the person
anyway. I love the person anyway.
I love the person anyway. Yeah, I don't know what the truth is.
Yeah.
And then we don't feel so defensive because we get lied to every day.
Yeah, we like constantly.
The best one was a kid told us, this is back when we had a treatment center together, a kid told us that he was an Iraqi veteran and told us all these horrendous things he had done. And I'm just an old junkie, and I was like, that kid don't look old enough to go to Iraq. Remember that?
Right. Yeah. And, no, but, it still
but
happens.
Dr. Blum and you both believed that we're, and we had a PTSD expert come down.
Right.
Finally, like you talked to Robbie's mother, I talked to this kid's mother, and I said, so how long was he in the service? And she said, what
He's
service?
Never been in the service.
But Jeff,
and we had him having a PTSD therapist.
And so to me, I just kind of shake my head. I don't feel violated by that. I'm just like, oh, geez. My thing is like, oh, how insecure must you feel about yourself?
Me?
Or him.
Yeah.
Or this kid to have to concoct these stories that you think we need to hear in order to connect to you and to feel okay and, you know, feel
and
sorry for you.
And that's what you feel, that connection. I want to relieve that sadness and that fear from the person, right?
We got to take a break. You have an Indiegogo account. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. I was going to punctuate what you just said too by saying that I feel like everything with Ralph was like larger than life.
Yeah.
He was a
big
person.
That's the histrionic stuff.
And everything was big and wonderful, and fun. And so, I mean, there were times where I was like, "You're full of shit." Like, I know you're lying to me right now, but you kind of just make a pass because you know, like, it's. It's got a great reward.
Were his comedian role models? I'm assuming Richard Pryor, Freddie Prinze,
and all,
Kinison. These are not the greatest role models in the world.
Not in life,
But you know what Ralphie could do that I've never seen anybody else do quite? He's like an orchestra. He's like an orchestra leader. The audience was like his orchestra, and he could literally like make waves go through it. I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen a
talent.
I've never seen that. I was like, and I was affected by it too. I was laughing and laughing my ass off. But he would just like a maestro taking a huge group of people and making them do what he wanted them to do. The craziest thing I've ever seen. What's the matter?
So we want to talk about the documentary and the Indiegogo.
Okay.
And then we're going to say goodbye to Periscope.
Okay, bye Periscope.
But after we talk about that, because I want people to know about your Periscope.
The documentary.
So Ralph left this incredible gift, and it's a really long story how we've gotten to this point, but he left a 1-hour special behind. We did a documentary. I said Ralphie was involved in trying to do this thing. So we asked about the weight loss surgeries. He had wanted to get lap band, a third surgery. I was so against it because he'd already had two prior surgeries. But
and he had clots and all.
Oh God,
really
I was so
risk.
Against
yeah,
it,
yeah.
But.
I bet you can always find a doctor that'll do it.
Yeah. Well, I was like, can we just put duct tape over your mouth? Like, what's the difference? We can keep cutting up your intestines, you know? So anyways, I began to recognize that anything we could do to get the weight off his body, because I told him, I said, you'll be dead in 2 years. We have to do something.
Yeah.
And so I will move forward with you, and I will help you through this lap band. And then I hired... And he helped as well. He wanted to do it. We hired our friend Kat Reinhart, and we started to film him in this weight loss journey, which clearly didn't work. And actually, insurance would not pay for it. And so it became a question of him just doing it on his own, which he didn't want to do it on his own, which is why he wanted the lap band, which wouldn't have worked anyways. So in the process of recording this journey, we also recorded a ton of stand-up. And so we have this amazing collection of bits that we can put together for people so we can give one last 1-hour special. And then we have this documentary, which is in the final phases of being edited. It's almost done. And we're trying to do crowdfunding to finish the rest of it, because believe it or not, his accounts were empty when he passed, which is a whole nother story about addiction and enablers. But yeah, so I'm
was
looking.
Was he giving money to people and stuff? Okay.
Oh my God. He had like $260 in his personal account when he died. God. And yeah, that's a whole nother story. And you would be in the documentary, except one of his, the worst person like that came into his our lives and like messed everything up, actually took off with some of the hard drives. And so we actually came in to your
radio
show about 3 years and some change ago. Yeah, and one of the hard drives was us in your,
in the radio studio. I remember that because that's the only time I'd ever met you was at the radio studio until I saw you the other night.
Yeah.
Maybe we have the audio somewhere.
You probably do. Yeah, without doubt you would have the audio.
Maybe we can find out.
Yeah, but I mean, we have like this whole hard drive that this guy based. I mean, it's a really long story, but he's one of the people who stepped into Rafi's life and like and caused a lot of problems. But the enablers are what fascinate me. But
should we?
But anyways, Indiegogo.
We're exploiters. Well, let's call them what they are. They're the exploiters. They're not enablers as
what
much
is
as
the,
exploiters.
What is the Indiegogo?
So I don't have the Indiegogo account name right now, but because we haven't actually launched the link, but it's going to be up on Indiegogo, and it's Rafi May. And if you follow social media, you can. We'll be posting everything. I believe we're starting July 10th.
What's your say Twitter handle?
Just Lana Turner, LAHNA Turner, TURNER.
Well, you've heard me speak about the supplement Bergamot for about 2 years now, and most recently their sport formulation, which helps reduce inflammation, shortening workout, muscle recovery time. But I want to come back to the formula that originally got me excited about the brand. That is the Bergamot Mega Plus. Yep, the Mega Plus O uses key extract from the bergamot citrus fruit. It's a unique fruit, extremely rich in polyphenols. They've been shown to reduce the risk of heart disease, polyphenols. And Bergamot Mega Plus O works like a natural statin, right? For these medications you use to lower cholesterol. Well, this works in precisely the same way. In addition, though, it addresses another condition called metabolic syndrome, which is abdominal fat, high cholesterol, high triglycerides, high blood pressure, insulin-resistant metabolic syndrome. It helps with that. It also helps with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Now, physicians can recommend different pharmaceuticals for these conditions, but Bergamot Mega Plus O offers the all-natural solution. Cardiologists and physicians worldwide do recommend Bergamot. Its effectiveness is the subject of many scientific publications. I've taken it myself. I have recommended and have patients on it right now. And for a limited time, Bergamot is offering our listeners 25% off any of the supplements by entering the code DRDREW at checkout. That is Dr. Drew, all one word, at checkout. To learn more, visit bergamet.com. That is B-E-R-G-A-M-E-T, B-E-R-G-A-M-E-T.com. And remember that use that code Dr. Drew at checkout.
We only have one rule at a Rafi May show, and that's to have a good time. So who here is ready to have a good fucking time? Let's go! You know who you need to see. Put your hands together for Mr. Rafi May, everybody.
Hey, everybody. How are you? Thank you for the water rats. I'm making sure I don't drown. Wasn't always a lesbian. She'd been married for 10 years to a son of a bitch. He was an asshole. He hit her, but she couldn't make breakfast. I see both sides. My agent called me up, right? And he goes, "Are you sitting down?" And I go, "Always." "Yeah, I'm flying upside down. I can't take your call right now."
I apologize, ma'am. I will get to jokes you approve of.
I told every woman I've ever been with, don't you ever come to my bed with no soapy tasting pussy meat, bitch. If I smell a soapy giner, I'll make you put your clothes back on and run around the block 4 or 5 times. I ain't got no time. Those big dog titties, they weren't droopy at all. They were perky, fucking great, big monstrous titty. With my favorite nipples, the baloney fadeaways. Providence white people look down on fucking East Providence white people, look down on North Providence white people. When truth is, all the Newport white people are looking down on all of us.
That's a little sizzle from what's coming, right?
that's a little sizzle of the stand-up. Each little chunk is from a different city, and he was so good. Every time he would go to a new town, he would riff for the first, 15, 20 minutes about where he was.
Would he go do a little research? Would he walk around? And
no, he was
just
pick
it
so
up and just
good.
Absorb it. Yeah.
He'd been doing stand-up half of his life, and he could just more than half of his life. So.
But still, that whole riff he did about Providence and all the different regions, I mean, how did he know that?
He's so smart.
Yeah.
Ralphie was so smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he could just pick up on stuff. And hence the ability to, win people over and still charismatic.
And manipulate and do all those good
things,
too.
Well, yeah. So. I mean, I fell in love with a really smart guy.
Yeah.
Just really troubled, but yeah.
Yeah.
They usually are.
Yes. And we're all a little messed up. I mean, I know I'm fucked up too. I mean, it's just all part of the whole thing, right?
So, what are you doing for you to get over all this?
I've been consistently going to therapy for a year and a half. I found the Maple Center, which is great.
It's very good.
Very good. It's structured so that you can afford it. Because that's one of the things about therapy, man. You go to a therapist and you leave there and you're like, that was an hour of my life and I could have gone on an airplane and I could be in I could be in Cuba. I could be doing a totally different kind of therapy right now. Whereas not to shitbag on anything, because any help you can get, but I mean, you can't afford to go every week. Whereas at Maple Center, they require you to go every week and you can afford it. So,
and are they doing groups still?
At Maple?
I'm sure they do.
Are they doing group therapy as
I
well?
I did a group parenting class.
Okay.
And
they've got a lot of different programs.
Yeah. They got some stuff for your children too?
My kids go every week. And then we did some family therapy too with the kids. And also another cool thing that I found for the kids is, and they have group for adults, but I haven't been able to go, is Our House, which is a grief center that help people with mourning. And my kids went to Camp Aaron this summer, which is amazing. So it's for all the children that were at this camp lost either a parent or a sibling in the last 3 years.
Wow.
And then this weekend we're going to a Dodgers game because the Dodgers sponsor Camp Aaron and Our House. So they give away tickets. So the kids will be with their friends from their cabin.
Oh my God, that's great.
It's so great.
How old are the kids?
My son just turned 9 and my
daughter's
10.
By the way, good on you for going out and finding the right services and stuff and affordable. So that's why I always tell people there's affordable stuff out there, but you have to do the legwork. How'd you find out about it?
Another widow.
That's important. You find out from the people who know.
Yeah, who've been through
Everybody thinks they're going to call the back of their insurance card and the magical things are going to happen. Yeah. It's not. You have to be vulnerable and talk to people and reach out to communities, and people don't want to do that.
Or, I mean, right now, maybe there's somebody out there who just heard that. Because I didn't know that existed. Somebody had to tell me. And then you have to take the initiative to apply. I mean, there was an application process. They do a phone interview and in-person interviews.
Where'd you grow up?
Canada.
Yeah.
Then Texas.
Don't you want to move back at this point?
To Canada?
Yeah.
Politically? Yeah, I mean, though, it's cold there.
What part?
The only drawback.
I was born in a place called Sarnia, which is a small town in Ontario, and then raised in Toronto, and then moved to Texas when I was 13, where I met Ralph. But I love Texas, but I don't really claim it anymore. I'm so LA, I hate myself. I love LA.
Don't give up your Toronto roots.
I'm Canadian.
Kids in the Hall are from Toronto.
Yeah, no, I'm Canadian Californian at this point. But
what was your comedian heroes?
Oh my God. Well, I play music on the guitar. So, I really love, so if I was to aspire to different.
Steve Martin.
Yeah, he's amazing. Believe it or not, Rodney Carrington is one of my favorite comedy songwriters, and people don't give him enough credit for as brilliant as his songwriting is. I mean, he has some funny songs, but I'm a big fan of comedy. I mean, I can watch an open mic and crack up at somebody.
Well,
so.
Just so you, when you say the word Toronto, to me, it's Kids in the Hall.
Yes.
Because I was in a band, and I remember we played the El Macambo, which is the most famous club there in history. The Rolling Stones played there, Elvis Costello. And I was walking from the bus, and two of the Kids in the Hall guys were going to the guest list, and I was like, holy fucking shit. It was one of the greatest moments of my life. All right? Because if I've just been a comedy fan since I was 7 or 8, and I wanted to be a stand-up, but I was too scared. It's too weird of a
job. Do it
now. I've been thinking about it.
Get on stage. It's so much fun. It's never too late.
It's become sort of they are kind of the current rock stars, right? That's kind of
the
same impulse.
Kevin Hart is.
There's
one current rock star.
No, I don't mean just in terms of how they're perceived. I mean in terms of what the impulse was to be a rock star. It's a similar impulse
out
there.
Yeah, the social.
People want to be stand-up, huh?
I think that's it's a similar impulse now. It's sort of an antisocial impulse at its core, right? It's these people theorize that, but it's wanting to hold an audience and make a difference, and you know, commune with
influence
people.
The culture,
influence
and
the
stuff
culture.
Like that.
Yeah,
it's so much fun. And I mean, as far as rock star lifestyle goes, I mean, I was just in Vegas last night. I mean, and
did you perform?
Yeah. And I definitely like. I am not a mom when I'm on the road, and I'm so responsible all the time that I get to actually, when I get on the road, I get to be irresponsible and stupid.
So let's, a lot of people at home don't know, and we've talked about it a couple times. So it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, right?
To do the gigs?
Yeah. So you're by yourself, but usually if you do improvs or whatever, you do Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Wednesday through Sunday.
Depends.
Two shows on Saturday.
Uh-huh.
So seven shows through the total.
Sometimes two shows Friday, two shows Saturday. Depends on.
Right?
Yeah.
All by yourself. You maybe have somebody go with you. It's not like being in a band where you got 20 other people around you to be
a part
of.
Are you watching I'm Dying Up Here?
Yes, I haven't been able to watch it, but there
is a community you're a part of is why I bring that up.
But it is a lot of drinking because a lot of the casualties of comedy were acquaintance of mine, like Hedberg. And
right.
Like, it's so sad because you get sober and then you're going to go be lonely by yourself around people who want to drink and take drugs with you. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, listen, Louis in his series explored that a bit.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's not a drug addict, though.
Well, but he was talking about the alcohol and stuff. And
alcohol. Every comic is.
Do you feel obligated to drink? Sometimes you do.
So I started stand up in Houston, and I wandered into the old Laugh Stop there, and there was some of the funniest comics I've ever seen that live in that town.
Yeah.
And their careers never went anywhere because of alcohol and. Their inability to leave that bubble. And so watching that, I decided that I would not drink in clubs.
Wow.
Because
wow.
Yeah, yeah, but you're Jew, you're Ashkenazi Jew, right?
Yeah.
So there's not so much alcohol genetics there. So it's easier
so for you can make that not. Rule.
Yes. Yeah. That's the point.
But
that's the point.
Last night in Vegas, after my set, because I also like to be on stage. I like to be coherent. Like it was anytime I've gone on stage a little bit buzzed, I have a hard time keeping
my focus.
No, but
it's usually from 12:30 till 4 in the morning is what I'm talking about. It's,
in the venues?
Afterwards.
Yeah, afterwards, the drinking.
Yeah.
And drugs.
Bob's actively romanticizing this right now.
I
know. I was one time, let me tell you my best Kinison story. So I'm at Duke's next to the whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
We're all like in awe of Kinison.
Yeah.
Bunch of musicians. We all idolize comedians, ironically. So he walks in. So fucked up at like 10 o'clock in the morning. And he's, you know, they had bench tables and he sat right across from me and AK.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just like, and we want to talk to him. And he just ordered something and then he took something out and poured a drink and he drank it. And he just put his head down on the table and fell asleep inside the restaurant.
Oh my God.
And we're like, holy fuck.
Oh,
yeah.
Geez.
That's
right.
That sounds familiar. But yeah, but like, well, for me,
he had busted terrible sleep apnea though, Ralphie.
Well, he got tested for it and had it, but refused to use the machines. Like I was married for the majority of my career, and then I've had had two small babies, and I would be out on the road with them, and I had a husband that took a lot of work to take care of, and just to navigate and maintain all those different plates in the air were different than now, so. So as of now, when I go on the road, it's a completely different thing and a little bit more frightening in terms of what you're talking about because I have the ability to be irresponsible on the road and do things that I'm like, okay, I need to be careful because of my, I had a lot of fun last night.
Oh, Ricky, feel a little guilty.
Not last night, the night before.
don't feel guilty for having fun.
Yeah, no, I just have to be careful because there's accessibility. Like, I mean, people become accessible and things become accessible. I mean, I'm not a pot smoker, but before I get on stage, I get joints put in my hand and in my pockets. And that's awesome. You know,
you ever do Upright Citizens Brigade? You ever been there?
I have not.
Smoke pot before they go out and do the most amazing shit.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do it. I watched them smoke pot. I'm like, you guys are about to go out without a net for an hour and a half, and you're going to be stoned on pot? And they're like, fuck yeah.
Okay. Do you do improv in addition to stand-up?
I've done improv when I first started comedy, but I love stand-up because I felt like with improv, at the end of the night, if it doesn't go well, you've got five other people to blame. But if I'm and doing stand-up, if anything goes wrong, I can figure out how to fix it for the next time, and it's just me. And I love that. I'm the only one writing it. Mm-hmm. I'm a comic. But yeah,
and it's such a great expression of, you know, your whole history going out onto that stage. And that's what I love about comics is the honesty.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty honest about everything. I don't have a filter.
I thought you were pretty brave.
Well, I think the natural comparison is Sarah Silverman, right? Is that you must get that?
People will, because she plays guitar and she's Jewish.
But it's actually very different. I see the difference.
Sometimes I feel like Sarah is playing a character. I don't think it's her. Really.
Oh, it's not her.
Yeah,
it's a piece of her. It's a piece of her.
Yeah, but not like really bearing it all out there. It's all different types of confessional comedy and who I am. You know, Louis C.K. is that person.
Yeah.
There's no separation.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. Except for his obsession about jokes. I've never seen anybody so disciplined about putting a stand-up routine together. Right?
A lot of comedians are that way, right?
Yeah, I mean,
you saw Aziz do that. We went to the Comedy Cellar together last year, and literally we walked upstairs, and they just got done. Aziz had his notepad out, and he's like, obviously did not want to socialize. You know what I mean? How is it with amongst comedians with you? And you're probably around mostly boys, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
is it competitive?
Well, a lot of comics are competitive. I don't feel competitive with most people because I feel like if somebody's got something and they're successful, then maybe that can happen for me as well. And also I don't have room for that. I've been super busy all these years just with basically being a single mom. I mean, even when Rafi was around, I was a single mom. So trying to raise two babies and do stand up, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. But so I've never felt competitive. No. I mean, but I love telling comedy, but where I'm different from when I get on stage to where I get off is I'm kind of introverted. I always was. And my friends who knew me growing up, my previous career, I was a photographer. I used to shoot for news and wire services. So, I mean, I would wear a baseball cap and hide and try and take pictures of what was going on around me and not outgoing. So when I'm on stage, though, I get to kind of project.
Be another part of you.
Yeah, that can come out. But then when I get off stage, I'm
baseball cap.
More so. And then, so it's wild. Like, people are like, you know, I've been invited to have threesomes with people off stage. And I'm like, wait, that was an act. Like, I'm not going to go and have sex with you. But maybe now I can.
So if you're comfortable, I want to drill a little bit into, you sort of glossed over your own piece of your relationship with Rafi.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if there's stuff in therapy you're going over or things that you could share that other people would learn. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean,
because you really glossed that. You went like, well, I have my own stuff. And then, gone.
Let's not deal with it. Watching the documentary, it blew my mind because I realized why Rafi left me. I mean, I'm literally the poster child for codependency in this thing.
You were controlling and
I was trying to control everything, and that it surpassed logic.
Did you grow up in that kind of a family system?
What do you mean as far as like codependent?
Controlling.
Or maybe so. I don't know.
You laid it out to him, if you recall. You said that very first meeting. Listen, if you want me to help you,
I will never stop.
I will never stop. You told him before you even started dating.
Yeah, I did.
But what kind of family did you grow up in? Was there any religious intensity or anything?
No.
Or?
I mean, I grew up in a very reformed Jewish household. Very reformed, yeah. I mean, we
were they at one time very.
Did they know the difference between Hanukkah and Passover?
Yes. Yes.
That reformed.
But, you know, no candles on Friday and no kosher, like nothing like that. Just, you know, I had some Jewish exposure, but nothing too serious. But I think there's an addiction cycle in my family. Like my grandmother, you know, she didn't have a pill problem. She just, you know, liked to. she's like to eat them and wash them down with vodka. You know?
Oh yeah,
that's
yeah.
good.
Yeah, she, yeah things no like problem. That. No
makes
problem.
Makes them work better.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. She has no problem taking them. She just puts them in her mouth and swallows them.
So there was you became codependent of some of the people around you, and then just brought that over to Ralphie.
Maybe so. My mom. I love my mom. I have a great mom, but she was very. She had every possible sickness or illness my entire childhood. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where she'd be like laying in bed and she'd be like, I'm dying tonight. And I'd be like, okay
so,
I'm out the door.
So that's histrionic, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Remember I said, yeah. And so that
did she really have the illnesses or was she?
No.
Okay. So I just wanted to clear that up. Yeah. Make sure if she had all
the
illnesses.
She's 70s now, so
she didn't have any illnesses. Okay,
but
eventually you will get some.
But it feels
again,
like
I don't want to say anything bad about my mom because it'll break her heart.
We don't think about these things as pejorative. We just think of them as just sort of descriptive, and we give them labels helps us understand them. But that sounds histrionic, and so you might have been attached to a histrionic person and then found another histrionic person to attach yourself to.
Yeah,
and codependents work like this because I'm both. So I need to be loved. And my mode of operation to be needed is to solve other people's problems. Mm-hmm. Ralphie's needs to be loved, and his is to be pathetic and need help.
Oh, my God.
And you fit.
Well, not
there's
pathetic.
There's a fittedness.
Meaning
no, I get
in,
it.
In need.
Yes.
There's a fittedness.
Yeah.
It feels like magic.
And then there's
when
another.
When you find that person
we
to fit with.
We were so connected. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's another layer to it, too, which is. Codependents tend to have bad boundaries, and so when the other person is having pain or something emotional, you see that as something special, and the inner child that's so injured and blah, blah, blah. It's actually not even his. It's yours.
Oh.
It's actually your stuff getting mobilized.
It's just an activation
of your stuff, but it feels like you're seeing something special in them. And they are having pain and stuff, and they're having these things, but the intensity and stuff is all actually yours.
But I think that love is real.
Yeah, I agree.
But you need to get healthy, and it seems like he was trying but couldn't. And you
well, let's reemphasize that because people don't talk about that. I think you're right.
There's a way to have that be real love, and as you grow together, you become more healthy, and you allow each other to have better boundaries and separation. And that's what ideally marriage and family therapy is supposed to do,
or even individual therapy too. You could do two individuals and get the same place.
And the example being, if I give you I know this is maybe painful, but if Ralphie had gotten sober and lost weight, got down to like 300, a manageable weight, you would have thought problems solved. They wouldn't have, because you still have your stuff that you would have had to resolve, right? You were so focused on him resolving his problems.
Well, but you're not as good as a codependent as we are. A really good codependent would go, he's going to gate it back. I got to stay on him. Problem never solved.
Yeah. Oh, my God. You guys are blowing my mind. I mean, yeah, the whole desire to be loved thing, I have an insatiable appetite and need to be loved, which hence stand up, because that's a total drug in itself, is getting on stage and receiving the love of an audience. And then in my life, when I meet somebody, I immediately love them so much, and I want that love in return.
Love
and that's tough. Like, I got to be really
any
careful.
PM Melody stuff.
I have no idea what that is. You guys are blowing my mind.
This is not.
Like textbooks.
We'll have you enroll.
Like sit in the corner.
Let her grieve first and get solid with that.
I'm just saying. This is not unfamiliar territory to us.
Yeah, but we do this all the time. Yeah. That's why we're like
publicly diagnosed.
I already knew, because you know yourself and you know you could fall in love really quickly, but in your own mind, it's not enough time yet, or something like that. Yeah. Right?
You mean time away? Look, this is
something you just described it in Vegas. Like, I don't know. I could fall in love, but I won't.
Well, you know, some of the favors that Ralphie did that were not favors at all, but for me they were good, is that he left me, and it was I had almost 2 years. So it took me like 8 months.
Yeah, but you're seeing him every day. All the time
no.
with kids.
No.
You're seeing them all
no,
the time.
No, he didn't see his children.
Oh, God.
So, yeah.
Since he was sick?
So, he didn't come around. I mean, so, okay. he left. He filed for divorce twice. By the way, he filed once, and I took him back. We tried to get back together, and then he filed secretly, and I don't know why, but I found the filing, and then I returned filing out of California because I was like, you can't file once, file twice. Okay, I get it. Like yeah. And he, by the way, the first time he filed was on the heels of like an oxycodone withdrawal, and the people that took him were the people. To the divorce attorney were the people who also carried him all the way to the end of his life.
Yeah.
So it was a really messed up situation. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so it got so ugly that I had to cut him off from me. Mm-hmm. Never cut him off from his children. He could be – the only thing that I maintained was that somebody had to help him with the kids because physically what you described with Kennison, with him falling asleep at the table, that was Ralphie to a T. He would pass out. And the children are young and they can't be around him by themselves. They need somebody that can help. And then some of the people that were around Ralphie also were not healthy people that
Let me ask
the kids.
You. So you talk about this inner circle that was enabling him or whatever. I just think probably exploiting him. But he had a lot of friends, and they all knew what was going on. Did any of them try to intervene, try to align with you? We got to fucking do something about him.
Or was he lying and hiding so good?
People talked to me about it. I don't even know the guy.
People would talk to me about it and then not have anything to tell me. They just go, I just know something.
No, I was told he was on drugs.
If you ever ask him exactly what's going on, they just go, I don't know, something.
Something's up. So, well, his good friends.
I don't even know the guy. I knew he was on prescription drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew he was on prescription drugs. I don't even remember where I heard it exactly.
Probably. There was a TMZ where he got wasted on stage in Colorado, and then they claimed it was weed, but it wasn't weed.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
But so here's why I ask. We've been trying to start this thing called Comedy Cares for years. As each comedian dies of drugs or suicide, we all get together and we go, we got to start this thing. And then it all just fades away and it never happens. We need to join the community, the comedy community together to have a drug and alcohol awareness and outreach and treatment and groups for comedians.
I wonder if it'd come in under Music Cares.
And like I think I'm asking too. If you want to do it because we're going to do it. And Ralphie died how long ago?
In October.
Daily.
Yeah. So we were. That was that night. We were over at that other comedian's house. What was that guy's name?
We were doing a podcast.
The 30 days he hadn't taken drugs for.
Bert Kreischer.
Yeah, Bert Kreischer. yeah. We were at his house and they went to the memorial.
Yeah.
We talked about it then in October. Now recently, you know, there's been more talk about it because there's been some overdoses.
Let's go do Bert's again and we'll push him on it.
We got to get – but we need buy-in from the comedy community, right?
Yeah. You know who would be great to get involved in this, which would probably fix a lot of the problem, would be not so much the comics but the managers and agents because
– That's who's starting it. That's who's doing
good,
it.
Good, because – I mean, I'll tell you what. It's easy for a comic to go on the road because every gig they do, you're going to get 10%. So there's like no incentive to pull this person off the road.
No, there's
and get
a lot
sober.
Of managers who have a lot of dead comedians.
Yes.
And they want to start something. It's
That'd
coming
be great.
From that part of the industry. But we already did this in the 90s with musicians. It takes musicians. It took me and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Bonnie Raitt and a bunch of people to get with the treatment professionals and the managers and the record companies to come together and build a thing.
I heard Lana say she's in, so
we're going to do it.
Yeah.
So I'm handing you a little book referral.
Okay.
It'll be a melody.
Facing Love Addiction.
It's a really good one. It's a really good book.
Okay.
Like the first 100 pages.
What about the old standards of Codependent No More? And
This gets at all that same stuff. It's just she has a great way of writing.
But I'm saying you've read those, haven't you?
No, I read Codependent No More, which I was like, everything in there describes everybody.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then,
you're going to like it. I'm telling you.
What actually that book led me that like there was one thing in there was like you've got to put yourself first and do something for yourself. So while I was reading that book, we were in Vegas and the kids were very little and I was like, and they said to allow the person that is the addict to have responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I was like, we're in a hotel. We had free access to the spa. So I said to him, I said, I'm going to go down to the spa for 3 hours. I'm going to get a facial and a massage and let you play with the kids. And you can take them to a movie. You can take them bowling because it's all inside the casino. It was at South Point. And so I went down to the spa. I come back 3 hours later. He's passed out. And the kids had cut each other's hair with scissors they'd found in the – yeah. And I was like, I was like, if you codependent –
that doesn't work.
No more. I cannot leave my children alone in a hotel. Like
a contained environment.
Yes.
So you'll like this better.
That did not work.
You'll like this better. It's more theoretical. Yeah, it's more theoretical.
I'll definitely look into it.
All right. Well, listen, Lana, pleasure. Thank you. And thank everyone, you. Go see the stand-up special. Is it? We saw it on Amazon. Can you get it anywhere?
Which special? My special?
Your special, yeah.
Right now it's on Amazon and iTunes. It's coming back out on – they're going to re-release it on a new platform. The distribution company went out of business, but I'm working on a new 1 hour. And the – Indiegogo will be up and running by the time this comes out.
Great.
So go to Indiegogo or LanaTurner.com, you know, my stuff on social media.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Oh, wait, podcast. I forgot
to say. Oh, yeah. Don't forget the podcast.
Oh, yeah. The podcast. Yeah, Perfect 10 Podcast, too. And since all your listeners are into podcasts.
What is it called again?
That. The Perfect 10 Podcast. And it's really fun.
Usual platforms?
Usual platforms.
Okay. See you there.
Perfect. Thank you, guys.
Thank you
so much.
Bye.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Check us out at KBC, being Lawrence Savon, 790 Midday Live Talk Radio, Monday to Friday. You can also tune in every day live via the magic of the internet at kbc.com. If you miss it, we've made it simple for you to find all the shows at drdrew.com, the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, the Single One I Do By Myself, the Dr. Drew podcast, This Life, of course, with Bob Swole Patrol, Mike Cantho, at his new health and fitness podcast. You can find us on Twitter at This Life Podcast, at Dr. Drew, Dairy W, at Rehab Bob Forrest, and of course, our lovely producer at First Lady of Love. I think I know who that is. If you love this show, please subscribe and tell a friend. We appreciate it when you do. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. Send us a message. Join the email list at drdrew.com, drdrew.com/contact. You'll also get a weekly email from us on that. While you're at it, at doctor.com, please support our sponsors by clicking through the banners. We only advertise products that I can get behind. So thank you for supporting them, those that support us. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.